of the darkness and into the light. It's the This Woman Knows podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of This Woman Knows podcast. I am your host, Lisa Ann Alexander. Today is a very special show. We're going to talk about mamas. And my special guest today is Mr. O.G. McClinton III. Today marks the 7th year that my mama, Bishop Gwendolyn G. P. Mack, that she transitioned and took her rest. And so O.G. is grieving his mom. She passed away earlier this year. And so we're going to talk about what it is to care for our elderly parents, in particularly Black women. We're going to talk about the care that our mothers should have received from the healthcare system but did not. And then finally, we'll talk about what we've learned through this process and what we wish we could have done differently. Now, this is going to be a two-part series. Today, I'm talking to OG, and in our next episode, we're going to talk to Dr. Charlotte Spencer, and she's going to walk us through on advocating for our loved ones and then finally advocating for ourselves when it comes to end of life. So everybody, sit back and enjoy the show. It's going to be a good one.
OG, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited about this opportunity to speak about my mother, your mother, but also it's very difficult because for me, it's really super duper fresh. You know, we're still having those firsts experiences. So, you know, it's been a challenging year thus far.
I completely understand. And again, my condolences to you and your family and to Candace. I completely understand. I know this road well.
Yes, I know. Remember when you went through that yourself, with your sister as well. So, you know.
Yeah. So tell me about, I know Sharon from back in the day. I know her. She was in the choir. We were in the choir together. So tell me about Sharon Harley.
Sharon Harley. My mother was the life of the family party. She had this wonderful energy that would keep the family in laughter and joy whenever we were together. She was a fierce protector. She had to do a lot of things that, you know, as a single mother for the majority of the time that we were of my childhood, you know, she had to have dual roles. But she remained this this constant stay of discipline because she had a child that needed to understand I had to be responsible because she wasn't there. And the harder she was on me and the more I understood what my responsibilities were, she felt safe leaving me alone by myself, you know? She was a wonderful woman, very complicated. You know, she had herself, what was funny is that her testimony was her testimony, but because I lived through it, I witnessed it, I experienced emotions because of it. She didn't quite understand that her experience was my experience. And so she felt like when I talked about it, that I was speaking of her, but no, we went through those things together, you know, the highs and the lows. I miss her so much.
I get that. And I completely understand. Our mothers were complicated people, you know, and we all have our issues. We all have our flaws, you know, even our parents. And it's quite the moment when you realize that my mama is human. You know, she has human frailties and she makes mistakes. And, you know, my mom was a single parent for a season too. So we have that experience in common as well. And so watching her navigate divorce and watching her navigate dating, that didn't go so well, especially with Jessica. That That didn't go too well.
One thing that I do regret about my mother in relation to relationships is that I never felt that she found someone who loved her the way she deserved to be loved. Wow. That she deserved more. Mm-hmm. You know, she was on a love journey and she died as a single woman, unmarried, without having a bond of, you know, that wow. type of relationship. So I feel like that was, you know, one of the things that was unfair about mm-hmm. life for her, is that wasn't her experience. You know, spiritually, God kept her through it, you know, but still there is
still.
A human connection. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, even though we were there, I felt like she felt that she was leaving this world alone. And probably was one of the reasons why she was ready to go.
I get that. Now, Bishop Mack, on the other hand, was completely different. She was, she went out of here kicking and screaming. Mama had 12 strokes, 12 of them. Mm-hmm. And they happened in sets of threes. And so the first three, she was able to recover. The second three, there were some mobility issues, maybe a little cognitive, but that last set, it's like, we're not recovering from that. And she always spoke of recovering, how she wanted to drive again. And she was ready to get back in ministry because she loved ministry. She loved everything about it, the people, especially the people, and meeting people and ministering to people, especially where they were. So at her funeral, I listened to people talk about my mom in ways I had no clue, just no clue about the women that she had blessed, because, you know, in some circles, women in ministry is still very taboo.
Yes.
In 2023 or 2016, when she passed away. And these women said that she took them under her arm and would teach them and school them and, you know, tell them you don't have to project as a man when you're behind the pulpit, one, because you're not a man.
Right.
Be you.
Well, and I mean, your mother, she swept through Mount Zion and brought a new standard of femininity, you know, with her handkerchiefs. You know, she would make them and sell them. Everyone had a handkerchief, you know, to be modest in church and cover your legs. Yes. But it also brought a sense of collective womanhood and femininity into the house of God. The whole church, I mean.
That, you know, was Mama.
Yes. But that was her. And I remember, I mean, there was a shift in the women. She didn't have to be, you know, the president of the women's, you know, missionary department. Her presence, and women saw her strength and, mm-hmm. you know, her power, and wanted to emulate that.
Yeah.
And she made an impression on an entire church. I saw that myself. You know, and my mother was a direct, it was a direct connection to that.
Yeah.
I saw her, you know, experience that change too as a woman. Yeah.
And one of the things I remember, and I'll share my memory of your mother, one of the memories I have of her, one is she loved being in the choir. Sharon was always in the choir, loved to sing, very passionate. I remember she loved you and Candace immensely. I remember if nobody else stood up for Holy Inspired, Sharon was going to stand and cheer us on in whatever it is that we did. And I always appreciated that about her, her love for family, her sister. Sharon loved hard, and that was visible from anybody standing on the outside looking in. Sharon loved hard, and she had an incredible testimony. I remember her testifying, you know, about her putting her cigarettes down and never picking up another one. Just a phenomenal being and fun to be around. So, you know, some people in church can be kind of stoic and, you know, fun died when they got baptized, but that was not Sharon.
No, that was not my mother.
No, not at all.
It was always fun.
So when did her health turn?
Her health turned shortly after her birthday last year. So I was in California because my father's oldest sister had gotten sick and it was terminal, and I wanted to make sure that I was there for my aunt. And it was an extended stay, And while I was there, you know, there was this cough that my mother had. And so one day I just went into the room. I was like, what is going on with this cough? You're just coughing all the time. And she's like, I don't know. I've gone to the doctor and they've given me, these inhalers. And they told me this. And she showed me all these things that she had. And so when my sister came in the room, I was like, well, are you using them? Well, no. Well, are you taking the medication? Oh, well, no. So we were upset with her because she was not being the compliant patient. But it was so much more severe than just having a cough or asthma or allergic to dust or something that might have been going on that she was complaining about. So she started coughing, February, March, soon after her birthday. She turned 70 on the 9th. And then there was just this persistent cough. So after a couple of months, I was like, you need to go to the doctor. We need to figure this out.
Yes.
And that was May. She went and had some tests done. So that first or second week of June, we had the appointment. And that's when it was announced that she indeed had cancer. So it actually was a very quick process. So a month and a half of coughing before I just said, that's enough. We got to go to the doctor, getting the results in June. And she passed away on September 29th of the same year.
So let's talk about, so your mother wasn't a compliant patient. Let me think.
She was not.
Was Bishop Mack compliant? There, I tell the story. This is a woman who struggles with high blood pressure. We can never get her numbers right. Her doctor was trash. And if I could have fired him, I would have. So she had a caregiver, and I was the one going over to mama's house and helping her clean, go grocery shopping, cooking for her on occasion. I go into the house and I smell fried fish. Fried fish has a very distinct smell, distinct. I go, Mama, who did this? It's like, who fried fish? And she says, what? Well, the caregiver. And it's like, no. So I had to have a little conversation with the caregiver. And it's like, I don't care. It's like, no, just no. So in that regard, food is such a hard thing. It's emotional. And it's really hard to give up. But she fought us tooth and nail. I would find Popeye's chicken and all the things. I'm like, Mama, you're not helping me here. You're not helping me. So I understand about the non-compliance from these very strong women. So tell me about the care she received, because I know that Black women's voices aren't always respected in the healthcare industry. There's just lots of things that go wrong when it comes to Black women and our healthcare, how we're treated. So what was your mom's experience?
She had a horrible experience with her medical treatment. With the cough, they just treated it as it could have been like a light asthma, or it was nothing that drove them to even do a CT scan or an X-ray. So they were just treating the cough. So her doctor, had he shown more concern, it's not like it's free, or she had insurance. So when you have insurance, the providers are paid. So what would it have taken for him to order a CT scan? So after my sister and I made a big to-do about it and she went to the doctor, we were like demanding, you need to make sure you ask for this. So she was assigned a pulmonologist, and that is when she's like, well, you need a chest X-ray. And she's like, you haven't had one? You've been coughing for 2 months? You should have had one a long time ago. So it wasn't until then, and this was now an Indian woman. She had different doctors before within the same medical group, and they kind of all worked together in the same building. So my mother's interaction with that particular doctor was the one that set us on the correct path. She finally ordered the CT scan, and it showed, you know, I guess points and places of concern. So, you know, it started off with being an area in her upper right chest that could have been fluid, as it was told, or it could be a mass, or it could be other things other than cancer, you know.
Okay.
So they wanted to do more tests. And after that, there were a few more tests. And I guess they were trying to confirm what they thought. And
yeah.
We're holding off on the information. So for weeks now, here you are, just, you know, left to your own devices and your imagination, and run away, you know. And unfortunately, the worst thought was true. We had the appointment with the oncologist, and we're told that it was cancer. And so her treatment in overall, my mother is a very interesting person. It could be fun and a joy to be around, but it can also be problematic for others. She likes things to be done a certain way, and if they're not, she will not hesitate to tell you that they're not.
Okay.
And so what happened, unfortunately, is that while she had her hospital stays, she would become known as the angry patient.
And let's be clear, not just the angry patient, the angry Black woman patient.
The angry Black
woman. The angry Black woman.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. With the attitude and, you know, just the,
yes.
the complaining, you know, but she would have legitimate complaints, the food. And it was even so much so that there was almost sarcasm even in the treatment. So the doctors, oh, well, since you can't eat, then I'm gonna put you on a puree diet. So I walked in, I'm looking, what is this? And you're telling a woman who was eating fine everything a week ago, and now, you know, she's on a puree diet because, you know, so it just seems like they were doing things to further antagonize her. And it's funny because I've been to so many different funerals where the families, you know, just applaud the nurses and the doctors and the hospice. Oh, everyone was so wonderful.
Yeah.
They know them by their name. It's almost like they're part of the family. Even the group there at the services most times, that was not my mother's experience at all. I didn't want to see any one of them. And I even told this one doctor from her group who happened to be Black. And I was like, well, doctor, I don't want my mother to become labeled the angry patient. He was like, well, I'm sorry, but it's a little too late for that.
Wow.
And he said, well, what you need to do is just get your mother out of here. Get your mother out of the hospital. That should be your main focus. So then we did what we could. She was in a skilled nursing facility for some time, you know, for the amount of insurance days where they have to make a decision on what's going on. And so the final stay, she left to go back to the hospital worse than what she came in. Med reconciliation was an error. They had stopped certain medications that she was on to help regulate, you know, her systems. They didn't even, you know, check the box to, you know, prescribe it again to continue in the nursing care. So it was horrible. She developed sepsis.
Oh no!
In the nursing facility. So when she went to the hospital for the last stay, she was a very, very sick woman because of the lack of care that she received in the skilled nursing facility.
So I know for myself, being in a similar situation, you don't in that moment. And it's like, how do I advocate for her? And especially when you don't have power of attorney. My mom was married. I didn't have power of attorney. Her husband, you know, had legal rights to say, do all the things. I didn't have power of attorney. She didn't have that paperwork intact. And so I couldn't change doctors. I couldn't force my hand because I wasn't legal, if you will. And so in those moments, you know, looking, so if I am, Mama passed in 2016, so I'm some years out. And I look back and I go, how could I have advocated for her better? What else could I have done? And I try not to torment myself, you know, mm-hmm. because we're the oldest, right? So you and I, yes. we're both oldest children. Okay. Yes. So it can really become a place of just this worry and this almost kind of guilt. It's like, is there anything else I could have done? Could I have forced my hand? Could I have made her husband sign over some, you know, but in that moment, you don't know what you don't know. I do know that Mama had, she had had all these strokes, and then she had to be rushed to the hospital again because they said it was Bell's palsy. So Bell's palsy, where you're, and we're going, this woman is known for strokes. So you want to tell me it's, and sent her home. And I'm going, this is, something's not right. And you know, you just, it's like, you don't know what recourses you have. You don't know what recourse you have in those moments. And it's like, okay, well, I guess she should come home. And I think it was shortly after that, she had her last set of strokes, and those were the game changers. And that was it. But that, it was shortly, that Bell's palsy never sat right. It's like somebody lying. I don't know. Yes. Who, I don't know who to call out, but somebody's lying.
And you want to trust the medical professionals. I mean, because really you have no other recourse but to trust them and hope that the information they're giving you is accurate. And when you leave out of the room and you're not there, I mean, I was coordinating my mother's care from Maryland, and it became like a full-time job. Mm-hmm. Even setting up her appointments with the transportation, working with her insurance, they never got it right. They were late, or they would take her to the wrong location, or because she couldn't walk like she wanted to, they didn't provide the services to help provide, you know, get her to the car, to the front door. It just became very cumbersome. And so just trying to coordinate the care was difficult, but then you would think that the medical professionals would understand, well, this young man is calling from, you know, I call myself young man. This young man with all his career, he's calling from Maryland trying to coordinate. So let's make sure that we're at least doing what we're supposed to do. But it became a second job that I hated, mm-hmm. only because I did not have the control. Because if I was running, you know, she would have been at every appointment, picked up, escorted, mm-hmm. there would be no issue. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I had to relinquish that. Mm-hmm. And the people who are in place, who are paid to do and provide those services, weren't providing them to the level of excellency or even to a level of service that would benefit my mother. So every day was a new saga. New reason to become angry, a day for me to cry because I wasn't there. And then it became expensive because I would travel on weekends, you know, so that's trying to go back and forth. And so, you know, it's the care, you know, I don't know why, even if a patient isn't a mean patient, nurses and doctors, they're trained not just on the medical part, but you know, they have different personalities too, mm-hmm. right? But you would think that at the nursing level that you have a certain tolerance, and you have a threshold, and you have an open understanding that these people don't want to be here.
Right.
They're in pain, mm-hmm. they're facing decisions and making decisions that I wouldn't want to make. So where is the compassion? And it wasn't every nurse, but because it was so inconsistent, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There was no way to, you know, establish a baseline for good care, because one day be a good person and next day be a crappy person. Mm-hmm. And that person was there for 2 or 3 days, you know. And even so, though you make yourself available, call me, my name is on the board.
Right, right.
Being non-compliant, I'm a part of the treatment team too, as a family.
Yes.
You know, it's not just the nurse, the doctor, it's the nurse, the doctor, the patient, the family.
The family.
And everyone's supposed to be a part of those decisions. So she's being non-compliant, call me. I have a way of talking to my mother to help convince her to do what it is that you think that she needs to do.
Never called.
Well, once or twice.
And I get it that nurses and the medical staff, the medical teams are probably still a little burned out from COVID, because COVID was a game changer for that community. I get that. But still, you still have to offer a level of care and compassion. So it's not just care and compassion, because you can give care and not give a hill of beans.
Yeah.
So it's care and compassion. And I know for sure, just by some of the clients that I have and that I work with, I know that Black women are less likely to receive that compassionate care when it comes to the medical field. So I can say that my mama's nurses, she had good nurses. I will say that every nurse that laid hands on my mama, they did good work. It was the doctors making the calls, the doctors who were a little lazy, and especially her primary care physician. You know, I don't understand how you don't get blood pressure medication right. If her numbers were never right, then that means you keep adjusting till she gets it right, till we get a normal reading, and don't just talk it up to, oh, well, what? It's like, no, get this right. And so that, I think that was the most frustrating thing on this end, them just not getting it right. And then just kind of like throwing up their hands like, oh, well, you know, mama wasn't 65 when she passed. That's still young for me, especially being a woman of a certain age.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Very young.
That was still young. Yeah. And I what I believe happened is when mama had her stroke, and it was a beautiful thing, because her granddaughter, Jessica's middle child, had gotten baptized and she couldn't be there. And she so wanted to be there, but her health just precluded her from doing so. And so I remember calling her that night, and we talked on the phone for a good hour, if not more. And I told her about how the baptism went. And I talked about, you know, how everybody said they missed her and how wonderfully that she had poured into people's lives. And she, you know, that she was just this jewel and so appreciated. And, you know, we had a conversation and we laughed and we talked, and we did this so her speech had kind of slowed down, but I could understand her. And it was this really beautiful conversation. And I'm grateful for it at that point, because the next day is when she had her set of strokes and she wouldn't talk again.
I see.
That was the last conversation I had with mama. And I don't think mama was ready to go. I sincerely do not believe she was ready to leave this earth. She had more she wanted to do. She loved her grandchildren. She loved her great grandchildren. And I think if I can just make up stuff, I'm gonna just make up stuff. I think that she didn't pass immediately. I think she had to, that God would give her grace or give her time to make peace with the fact this really is it, because it took 3 months. You know, her decline after that was about 3 months. And when she went to hospice, they said she tried to get out of bed and walk away. It was like I don't think mama was ready to go, but I think she finally made peace and she transitioned and she left out of here. Mama left out. This is how mama left. Her husband had just left the hospice. I'm sitting out in the car in the parking lot, getting ready to go in. I'm talking to Dory. Mm-hmm. So, all right, going in. Mama left here while I was on the phone in the parking lot, so I wasn't there for her last moments. And it's like, did she do that intentionally? because we sat. Because we sat, we were there for Nana Brown, right? So I don't know if you remember my grandmother, we were all there, and that was a hard.
Yes.
Oh, that's hard. That's so hard. And I don't think Mama wanted that. And she left out of there while I was in the parking lot. And it's like, you know what? When I see you again, we're going to have a conversation.
Yeah.
But that was caring for these dynamic women. It's not without challenges. My mom was a little feisty too, you know, and had her way of thinking this is how things ought to be done. Now, one of the things that her nursing team was good. Her doctors, I still don't like, I'm not happy with them to this day. I wish there had been better communication with the hospice team, because the way they came across, it's like, oh, it's just an extra level of care for your mother. It doesn't mean that she's getting ready to pass. It's just an extra level of care. Mm-hmm. The lies you tell.
Right. Right, so because when you move, that's the thing about hospice, is that there isn't any more physician contact. There's no more treatment for the disease or, you know, whatever it is that had you in the hospital. It's all about making you comfortable. And typically when someone says hospice, then you know that this is the end stage. Mm-hmm. But some people have been in hospice and have recovered.
Yes.
Others stay in hospice and live months or years, you know. You said your mom was there 3 months, you know, you know, my mother actually had made a decision to go into hospice because she did not want to have chemotherapy.
Understood.
Intravenous chemo. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was her largest demand. I refuse to have chemo. If I have to have chemo, then, you know, we're just going to let it go. And so she was on, so while she was on hospice, my sister and I, we were searching for these different programs to try to find some other options for chemotherapy other than intravenously. Yeah. And so a week in hospice, she started hospice on a Monday. On that Friday, got the call. She was approved for this new medication. It was one pill a day that she would have to take. And it actually was doing its job with the cancer.
Oh, wow.
But there were all the other things going on. Her kidneys started to fail.
Okay.
She had, you know, her hyperthyroidism. Mm-hmm. They found fluid around her heart. Then she goes and she has sepsis. There were so many other things that were going on around the cancer that just made her just a very sick woman. Mm-hmm. And to your point about it's not a myth that Black women are strong. However, what the way medicine has treated that is, well, they're so strong, they can handle it, they got it, they're not as in need as other patients are. Mm-hmm. So they don't get the care because, you know, it's in their DNA to stick it through.
Yeah.
You know. And then when you're the angry, feisty patient, that adds a layer of, oh, I got this. I'm, you know, just because someone says they got it, or that does not mean that is necessarily the case. They still need the help.
Yes.
They still need the assistance. And at the end, you know, even the night that she passed, the hospice nurse, you know, so they went to go pick her up at St. Francis Hospital.
Okay.
My mother was in Long Beach Memorial. So the coordination of care. St. Francis sounds nothing like Long Beach. So they were late even picking her up. The hospice nurse is obviously perturbed, trying to be nice, but frustrated. But it's like, well, this is not our fault. We didn't coordinate.
Right.
You all, matter of fact, the hospice, you all were the ones who coordinated that. My sister and I did not want to see her in the ambulance. So we stayed in the house waiting for them to come. The hospice nurse was in such a rush because she had to be on duty at midnight on call. And so she was trying to rush the process. So she went and she saw our mother and she came back and she said, oh, well, she's just resting. It's almost like she just comatose, just laying there. She used the word comatose. And my sister and I both thought, wow, that's a really weird word. That means a mother, she really must be resting. But it was such a strong word. But when they brought her into that room, her breathing was dilapidated. She wasn't conscious. It was,
wow.
Well, wait a minute. How did we get from comatose to
it was just her
grasping for her. It was just, you know, and so we stood there in shock because they were to have given her medication in the hospital to help her be calm for the ride. But again, transportation took so long. So did you all do any, that's the question. Did you do anything else at the hospital while she was waiting? We were told that she would stay on the same antibiotic therapy while she was in the hospital. But it was obvious that she was in such bad health. I know once we pull the record, we'll be able to see where they stopped the medication. And there was no more administration of this cocktail that the anesthesiologist was very excited about. He's like, no, you all are leaving. I was like, yes, she decided to go in the hospital. He's like, well, we this medication, it's working. It's going to work. I was like, well, when she's made the decision. So they were supposed to keep her on that therapy. But when she came through that door, the first thing was, no, they stopped it on Sunday. She's been so... It's almost as if they started hospice while she was in the hospital and didn't tell us that they did.
Okay. See.
So she came home and we asked the doctor, well, how long does she have? That was the very first time I asked the question. They said 3 weeks, which was a soccer punch to the stomach.
Yeah. And I think that's when I got the email from you. That's when you emailed me. Yeah.
3 weeks. And then when she got home, it wasn't even 5 hours. So my sister Candace had just left. And I was getting ready to turn the lights out. And I had issues about, they had medication, anxiety, something else. And I was like, aggravation. This is for anxiety. So I'm like, what's the difference between those two? Because the hospice nurse never explained the medications because she was in a rush to leave.
Yeah.
I'm on the phone trying to figure out, well, what do I do? She's breathing heavily. What do I do? So finally, after being on the phone about 45 minutes, they said, well, just give her a little bit of the morphine. It was a little drop. And it seemed to calm her down. And I was like, okay, so I'm going to lay down and myself and be ready for the morning. That's going to be our first day taking full care and what we have to do. And I went and I grabbed a quick bite to eat or something at my grandmother's table. I came in, I sat in my mom's chair, and I looked over at her and I was just like, you know, she hasn't moved from that position that she was in. And I just watched her. And so then I got up and I looked to see, well, is she breathing? You know, what's going on? So here I am. They didn't give me the education because the hospice nurse has left. I didn't know what to look for because the hospice nurse never gave us the education. I didn't know how to check. So I'm feeling a pulse, but it's actually the pulse of my fingers. It's my own pulse that I was feeling. So the lack of care and to the extent of care that they gave did not prepare us, so it made it so much worse. So now I'm feeling guilty. I'm wondering, well, should it not have been morphine? What should it have been? Should have been the other medication.
Yeah.
So you have all these things that I wish I would have, could have, if I had known, I would have done better. But they didn't do what they were supposed to have done to help us prepare and to get ready. So 5 hours. So my grandmother, you know, called the neighbor and she came over, and she's a clinical person who does rescue, you know.
Okay.
There's a hurricane and wherever. And so she put her hand on my mother's neck and like your fingers on her neck, and then she grabbed her arm. And as she stood there, she just said, "Oh, Sharon."
Mm.
Right away, I knew. I was like, "She's gone.
She's gone.
She's gone."
What a there's a friend of mine who lives in Florida who had a hospice situation completely different from yours and mine, completely different. So we're not talking about, this is a non-melanated person.
Mm-hmm.
The level of care that they received, I mean, all the instructions that they received, you know, she shared her journey. It's a beautiful story, beautiful journey. You know, she took care of her father for 7 months before he passed away. And her hospice situation doesn't sound anything like yours or mine, because again, all the information that she got, she was told what was going to happen, what to expect, you know, don't be afraid of this death rattle that happens. You know, it happens. It's just part of the process. Who to call when her father finally passed. And she got to be part of that whole process of preparing the body and bathing him one last time and getting him ready and sitting down. Her experience was so peaceful.
Yeah.
When he finally passed, you know, somebody had told her, and it's like, when that moment happens, go brew yourself a cup of tea and just have a seat and sit down, because it won't be that quiet again for quite some time. And her experience, just completely different. Yours was chaotic. Mine was chaotic. Just a lack of information. And the common denominator between you and me is we both have Black mamas.
Yeah.
And they were phenomenal women and deserved so much better in death from the healthcare community, from the hospice community, than what they received. But all they saw was skin color. All they saw was an agitated patient. You've got agitated patients come in all colors, regardless.
Yes. Yeah.
You know? So it's frustrating to watch someone you love go through it all, you know? It's so frustrating. So we both have similar experiences with the healthcare systems when the care of Black women. What would you tell other adult children, you know, in the same situation, you know, because we're Gen Xers and we're taking care of baby boomer parents, right? So how would you advise someone else like ourselves on how they can prepare for this and what they can expect and what they should do?
People need to plan and prepare and have those difficult conversations. So I didn't have power of attorney, but was working to get the paperwork done at the end in the last minute. And mm-hmm. she passed before we got documents notarized and signed. And so that just delayed so much, and, mm-hmm. and it didn't give access to things. And so when you're not prepared for it, it frustrates you even more, because you're now trying to do things financially. My mother was cremated, but I mean, it was thousands of dollars. And it's not like you get a cremation sale, oh, we're doing 2 for $500, you know. No. It's almost like a barrel. We're talking about $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, sometimes $8,000. I mean, it can be very expensive. And so I would say that you have to force yourself.
Yes.
To who are the beneficiaries? If you pass, who's going to be the one in charge?
Right.
Families sometimes they don't find out till they get the will, and the one brother thinking he was going to get it and the other brother got it. And so it's causing conflict and confusion. Mm-hmm. But if families know ahead of time,
right,
what is the plan, then I think it would save a lot of grief, a lot of anger and frustration. you know, not only with just coordinating care and planning the care, but also dealing with each other. Luckily for my sister, now we had a conversation. We're not going to do like most families. We're going to talk. We're going to communicate. We're going to get through this together. I don't want us to be upset with you. She said, I don't want to be upset with you either. So we had a conversation that we were not going to have any drama between the two of us. However it falls or whatever happens, we're going to just take care of each other and make sure that we're okay. So we had the conversation. And there was even some who had reached out when they found out that my mom was ill, you know, get the paperwork done. You need power of attorney. You need, you know, all of those things need to be set up, and they weren't. We were working, trying to do it, but it was too late. And so, you know, and then so I've even started writing my own obituary.
Been there, done that. Yes, sir. Yeah,
and actually have the program pretty much laid out. Like, this is what I want to have happen. This is what I want, you know, to take place. And I think if we can realize that death is imminent for all of us,
right?
You know, I wouldn't want to leave my family in disarray. So let me take care of it, not myself. Mm-hmm. Now and then have and discuss it with my family so that there are no surprises.
Right.
So the advice that I would give is just to plan and prepare and have the difficult conversations. Mom, where are the documents?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's in the closet somewhere, one of these closets. No, which closet? A, B, C, D, what shelf, what box? I mean, get the specifics so that you know right away, you know, what the business part of it is. Yeah. Because you're mourning and grieving and crying. You could be feeling guilty. You could be feeling, you know, all kinds of emotions about whatever happened. Right. But there's a business part of it too. And if that is not intact, it kind of disrupts everything. Because then sometimes it causes you to even delay the grieving process. Mm-hmm. So now you have this stress building up.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't look good or feel good either.
No, sir.
And so, you know, I think planning, preparing, having a difficult conversation. I mean, you just have to have it. And a lot of people don't want to talk about death.
No.
You know.
They
don't. But we all will one day. Yeah. When, what day? We don't know.
We don't know.
But while we're live today, we need to prepare and be prepared.
Absolutely. So, I think one of my favorite lines, Jay-Z, he says he was born in the trap. He's not afraid of death because we're all born to do that. It's like, sir, that is profound. Very profound. And it's like, so fearing it, it just doesn't make sense. We're all born to do that from the day we're born. You know, the clock is ticking. And for me, I think one of the things that mama's death, so walking her through this process, one of the ways that it changed me, it was traumatic in a sense, but kind of low key traumatic, because every time my blood pressure would go up or spike, and it was like, oh my God, I would freak out because, you know, is my mama's fate going to be mine?
Right.
So then that becomes a thing. I would, poor Elgin, that man loves me. You know, I would just really freak out. And I didn't know that providing care for someone can impact you and how you view your own health and really play with your head. And so for me, it was, Lisa, you're not your mama. You're your mother's daughter. But you guys live totally different lives. You know, it's different. And so, you know, all my blood work would come back clean. And it's like, so I would take a deep breath, but then you couldn't tell me, you know, something. So it was just this, it's amazing how giving care to someone else can impact you. You're watching them go through, you're watching them be in pain, you're watching them suffer. And you can't do that long-term, even for 3-6 months. This was a 2-year process for mama. I mean, from the time she had her first set of strokes and then, you know, up until the time she left out of here. And it's like, you can't care for someone like that in that manner and watch their health decline and it not impact you.
Right.
And so I'm all for care for the caregivers. And so one to add to what you were saying is, yes, get the paperwork done, have the hard conversations, and then don't be afraid to speak up on behalf of your loved ones at the hospital. Question everything. So your family's like mine, there was just two of us. So how do we court? Because folk got to work, you know?
Yeah.
Who can be at the hospital? So is there anybody from the church? Is there who? Because it's, treatment is better if there's a family member or somebody at the hospital with them. If they're there alone, that's when things get a little.
Absolutely. And my mother, she there was a long period of time where she didn't want visitors.
Oh. Okay.
She didn't want people to see her in that way. But it was like, well, you need to have, you know, you need people to come in and talk to you, you know, people to show you love. I mean, that will, you know, invigorate you. It would give you a reason to wake up and want to, you know, brush your hair or something, because, you know, you have someone coming. But for a long time, she didn't want to see anyone. So she was in isolation herself. And one thing too, as part of it, is that as her advocate, I had to fight where I thought it would just be conversations and requests made and follow up and follow through and call. But I had to fight every single day. Mm-hmm. And then having a good understanding of what benefits your loved ones have.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, having Medicare versus Medi-Cal or whatever the insurance is, there's different benefits.
Yes.
And so my mother was home for hospice, but she didn't have the benefit because she didn't qualify for Medi-Cal, that she couldn't have a full-time nurse unless we paid for it. So we would have had to pay for that. Or they release your loved one back home because the family is going to do it. So that's what we had decided to do. So you don't have to have, you know, those urgent conversations due to those traumatic revelations of what the financial situation and what the benefit really is, to know that. So know that, well, when mom gets sick or when dad gets sick, we're going to need the family to come together to make this happen because she doesn't have the benefit, you know. And the hospice nurse, they come, you know, they check vitals and they do different things. They may come once or twice a week, but there's no nurse that comes every day, you know? And so her, because of her benefit, it was almost better for her to be thought to be in the hospital because she was getting the care that she needed.
Yes.
But then she's the angry patient. I mean, so it was like, we were like, Mom, if you could just cooperate, but my mother, and I am her child, and I can go there real easily too. But when you're sick and in need, it's not time for you to have an attitude. What is this for? What are you bringing me now? I mean, just.
And see, that's when visitors can help kind of like temper
that.
You know, they can help temper that. And then that also, so even if it isn't family, if it is visitors, then again, you do get a little bit better treatment. At least the nursing staff knows that somebody's coming in. Somebody, she has visitors, she has watching. So, you know, we do have to have the semblance of that we are taking, have compassionate care going on.
Yeah, and you're right. And a present family helps. And then our cousins were putting together a schedule of how they were going to come and visit and do different things. So, you know, because of us not understanding the benefit and what was really going on. And then once I got there and I saw, I was like, well, this is not good.
Yeah.
Then we started to put a plan together, but it was like last minute ad hoc kind of thing, you know, only because we didn't have an understanding of what her medical benefit necessarily meant, and to what extent help she could get, you know, They were going to keep her in the hospital until we could either she was going to a hospice facility.
Okay.
And we researched those, and I was like, "Why are we paying that? Mm-hmm. That seems ridiculous." And then, or there's a nurse, or you have decided that it is the family, but you have to have a plan. We're not just going to release a patient home,
yeah,
to hospice. We have to keep medical legal issue that they have to keep them in the hospital until you can guarantee. But my mother, she just wanted to go home. She said, "Oh, gee, I want to go home. I'm tired no more." Mm. And that Sunday I was there. And because her kidneys were failing, the fluid was in her arms. Her arms were really swollen. Her hands are, and they were coming in to draw some blood. And you can see where, because her skin was swollen, they couldn't see veins. I mean, she just had pricks everywhere. And I was going like, "Well," and she's like, no more. No, oh, gee, no, I don't want any more. I can't do it. I don't want any more. No more blood draw." And I looked at the phlebotomist and I said, "You know what? That's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. We don't have to worry about it right now." So that's when she left, I had the conversation. I said, "Mom, so what do you want to do?" I said, "Do you want to go home?" I said, "You know, we can make you comfortable there. And she was like, "I want to go home. I want to go home." And that was on Sunday. And she passed that early that Thursday morning after just being home for 5 hours. So, you know, even talking with some of my friends, even though they did lots of preparation and had everything in place, it's still not a guarantee that there will not be chaos, and that but what it does, it lessens it, mm-hmm. right? But it doesn't
negate it,
negate it at all. There's still gonna be something.
Yes.
But the more you know, the less it is. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
The better you prepare. So if you have your obituary already written, right, mm-hmm. the life history, that's even stressful. Trying to get facts and calling people to get information.
Oh my God.
And you want to make, you know, just even putting the program to, there's so many things going on that you find yourself busy doing. And then the people are coming over showing love and you want to see them, you know, but then there's things you have to do.
Right.
And it just becomes a very stressful situation. Whereas if you have things already set up and done and in place, it allows you to grieve.
Yes, it really does.
It allows you to cry, as opposed to being so busy that you don't even have time to, you know. So I'm still in the state of disbelief. I really don't believe that my mother is gone. I just don't. It's like I'm living in this suspended place of disbelief. Mm.
I get that. I understand it. And when you were talking about preparing, so when Mama had those last set of strokes, and we knew, it's like, this is it. We knew. So Jessica and I, between the two of us, we said, let's start preparing. And so we had a plan. We called it Operation Push Play. So when it happened, all you had to do was push play, and this program would just automatically run. And so it was getting the obituary done. And I did her program. I wrote her obituary. OG, I would sit at my computer, do parts of her obituary, and lay my head down on my computer and just weep.
Yeah.
Just bawl. And, you know, that was enough for that day. And then come back, you know, later and do some more. And then just the same process, but we lined up everything as much as we could. And so when it did happen, we were able to just push play and let it take care of itself. And so I am grateful that there was a community of people that loved Mama, and they bent over backwards to make sure that her homegoing celebration was absolutely phenomenal. And so it wasn't this heavy lift for Jessica and I. It was not a heavy lift. And for that, I am extremely grateful. So again, and it's like, try to plan as much as you can, especially if you know that this is imminent, that it is coming. Just go ahead and plan, have the card. If you can have the hard conversations before it gets critical, before it gets terminal, you're that much better. Then you don't have to think about it. Then it's done. Then it's operation push play. You know, it's in a safe somewhere. Then it's like, okay, let's do this. But I would encourage fellow Gen Xers that are having to care for parents like OG and I had to do. In the midst of grieving and just all the questions, if something seems off, ask about it. If something doesn't seem right, ask. Gosh. And if you don't like the question, you don't like what you get, there's a thing called second opinions. We can find another doctor. If you're not willing to do what needs to be done, there are more of you in these white coats around here. We can find somebody else. So that would be my suggestion. OG. Thank you. I know this was hard. It's still so fresh. And I thank you for being willing to come on and talk about Sharon and the experience. And this will definitely help some other Gen Xers going through the process and who will go through the process.
Thank you for listening to another episode of This Woman Knows podcast. For show notes, blog posts, guest booking information, and sponsorship opportunities, visit us online at www.thiswomanknows.com today.